Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 403. And last time we're discussing some laws about multiple wives, in essence, you know, two wives and matters like that. And in that case, how to treat the birthright. And again, as we mentioned last time, obviously in today's society, in a society that is far removed from that reality, you know, we'll look at that time, that situation of those days, how people used to do things. They had more than one wife, and obviously there are many reasons why people want to have that in terms of the men. And, you know, we have our own concepts and our own ideas based on it, and then we basically decide what is right and what is wrong, and then we have our own emotions and feelings about it. And all that is based on what went into our brain. You see, had we lived at that time, our thoughts and feelings and emotions would have been totally different. And since we're not capable of doing it, stepping into the shoes of other people, other times, other societies, you know, we can just read about it. And obviously, we think the way we do. They would have looked at us in those days, you know, they would have had their thoughts about us too. And so, what we read here is the mind of God, based on the circumstances, and that's basically the way He instructed them to live life. That if a man has two wives, for that matter, if he had three or four or five, you see, in this case, he just talked about two. He should, you know, function in a certain way when it comes to his treatment of them, when it comes to birthright and things like that. And when you live in a society like that, in an agrarian society, a time when the whole world basically was an agrarian in nature, you know, with the exception of the few that lived in the city, now it's the opposite, just the other way around. But still, there are an awful lot of farming communities all around the earth, and not as much in the industrial world, but even in the industrialized world, you know, you find a lot of farmers, and, you know, their reality of life is totally different than those in the city. And so, obviously, everything that they do is based on that. And so, God is regulating this situation under the circumstances. And when you think about it, in that society, or even today, even if you are not on the farm, you know, think about it realistically, the way things are, unfortunately, not the way they were supposed to be, but the way things are, and basically on the way things are, that's how oftentimes many of the laws of God are given, based on that. You have to deal with reality, no, not just utopia, which is not there yet, and it hasn't meant for it to be there at that point, for many reasons, obviously. And so, under these circumstances, be it in those days or today, a man being a man, the way, you know, men generally function, when he has one wife, for different reasons, you see, she may be sick, she may be ill, she may be getting uglier or things like that, or whatever the reason might be, you know, she may have a totally contrary nature to what he is. What is he doing under the circumstances? Beside the fact that in a farming community, you know, he needs more than one wife to manage his farm, you know, to have a lot of employees, and that's one way he can do it. Not having money, you know, to go and buy some others. So, obviously, having more than one wife took care of that. But when all those circumstances are there, unfortunately, people they look sideways, you know, this way and that way and the other way, and they commit adultery, unfortunately, and they have, you know, they want to satisfy their own desires. This is not ideal, but God has to deal with it. God has to deal with the circumstances. And so they commit adultery because of lust, you know, illegal feelings. And from his point of view, from the point of view of the man, may not be legal from the point of view of the law, but reasonable, makes sense, you know, satisfies his needs. And if she's sick and he cannot have, you know, anything to do with her, you know, what is he going to do? Or if she's pregnant, you know, and for several months, you know, he cannot do anything. I mean, all kind of reasons like that, besides, you know, the farming conditions. And that's unfortunately, that's the way it works in a carnal society. And ironically, if it was not done that way, in those days especially, what would have happened? Exactly what is happening today. Broken homes, you see. Well, the husband, you know, may not want to take care of this wife, and he just, you know, throws her out, and she and her children go into, you know, immediately they fall into a state of poverty, and, you know, crime and all kind of problems like that. So in order to avoid many of these things, in essence, That's where the administrative, you know, decision is being made at this point. And when you think about it today, look how many men are not living a righteous life. An awful lot of them are committing adultery. An awful lot of them have mistresses. And oftentimes because there are situations in the family, you know, whether a wife or whatever reason, is not what they want. Either because she's sick or either because, you know, who knows what. So, you know, you think about the entirety of this matter and then you begin to understand it that way. And of course, some women would say, well, you know, I may have the same situation just like the man. I'm a human being too, you see. And my husband may be sick or this and that or the other thing and I need somebody else. Well, that's the way it worked, obviously. You know, and it doesn't sound fair, but that's the way it worked. Just like, you know, the rooster is one and there are many chicken. And, you know, the chicken, it just stuck with that reality. And so is woman. And obviously, had all been obedient to God, had all things worked and functioned properly, had the ideal was there as God meant for it to be, had the law of God being observed by all these problems that we have in the society and the many laws that even God himself had to, in essence, impose on his people would not have been. So we have to understand that we are functioning within a dysfunctional society, and many of the laws of God are based on a dysfunctional society, a society that departed from him. And so when we look at all these matters, then we have to find out, you know, what is it that is going to minimize the evil. And in essence, this law works in that direction. And so if a man, you know, is in that situation, God doesn't want him to live in adultery, you see, or steal. You know, if he doesn't have enough to eat, you see, if he doesn't have enough to eat, what is it that God said about a man? You know, if he walks down the road and he's hungry, he's on the road and there are trees on both sides, what does he do? Or, you know, there's corn there or things like that. He says, you know, okay, I said don't steal, but you got to deal with the situation, you see. You're hungry, what are you going to do? You know, I don't want you just to go and steal and rob and defraud. So he came up with a law, and he said, basically, if you're hungry, just, you know, go to your neighbor's vineyard or orchard or, you know, the wheat field, barley field, whatever it may be, corn, anything, and just eat as much as you need to eat, and that's it. You know, don't use any instruments to cut it down, because then it really becomes stealing. Or then don't pile up, don't put it in boxes and take it with you, that'll be stealing. But if you just take enough for you to eat, you see, you're in the position of a bird. You see, bird is hungry, comes down, you know, lights on your tree and eats. You see, you don't come and shoot the bird. And, you know, you realize that's a part of life, part of nature. Everybody needs to eat. You see, well, in this case, obviously, he doesn't want a person, you know, is hungry sexually or has other needs just to go to his neighbor's wife. You see, so to solve that problem, he said, don't commit adultery, marry her. And under those circumstances, an awful lot of men would not have committed adultery had they been allowed this opportunity to this very day. But since we departed the other way, you know, for different reasons, well, we're paying the penalty both ways. So all these matters, unfortunately, are a result of a dysfunctional society. And under the circumstances, that's how God functioned also. And he gave laws based on that. So this is what this law is all about. And in the beginning, as Jesus Christ said, it wasn't so. But in the beginning was the Garden of Eden. You see, we have no Garden of Eden. We haven't had the Garden of Eden since the Garden of Eden. So obviously everything is going to be totally different. And the question is, how do you function in harmony and unity under the circumstances? When we begin to understand that, you see, all the complexities of life, and why God had to give certain laws because of the complexities of life, and how they're applicable under those circumstances, and they're not when when those circumstances are not, you see, and that's that creates an awful lot of misunderstanding on the part of many people. When they look at the law of God, and they notice that some people, you know, they want to be obedient, and they abide by the law of God, but they don't necessarily keep every law. You know, oftentimes now and then some people will challenge you and throw at you, you know, this question and that question. Well, how come, you know, you don't offer sacrifices? Or how come you don't put tassels on or fringes, you see, and so forth. And they fail to understand the complexity of the whole matter and the circumstances under which the laws were given. And when they don't understand it, that's unfortunately where you have a lot of confusion and division and problems, and people say, well, you know, that's the way it is. You know, you pick and choose, I pick and choose, we all pick and choose, you know, and that's the way it goes. But they do not sit down to study the law of God and to understand the complexities of it and to understand the reality of it and the circumstances that determine, you see, when you obey certain laws, when you don't. And a person to begin with begins with a mind who desires the face of God, who hungers for His flesh, who thirsts for His righteousness, you see. Not a person that begins with a point of view of wanting to get away, you know, with this and that and the other thing as much as possible and be rebellious. And when you do that, then you also realize there are things that you can do, there are things that you cannot do, and God does not require you to do things that you cannot do under the circumstances. And when we comprehend that better, then we have a better understanding of the law of God and the reason behind it, you see, and when it is time to do it and when it's not time to do it. And it's as simple as that. And so we live today, even in the days of the Second Temple, the rabbis realized, look, now an awful lot of us are city people, we're not farmers, and they decided at that time that it's not good for men to have more than one wife. And they discouraged it and spoke against it, you see. So by the time, you know, the disciples and Jesus Christ were talking about these matters, how it was in the beginning, that was already a part of the community. And, you know, in the city, there was no need for more than one wife. And then that created also problems because not everybody could really support more than one wife, you see. And that's why Paul had to give that instruction, which became a law, that an elder, he didn't say the brethren, and some people failed to realize that because they could not speak against the law of God. What the law says, if you've got two wives, that's what you do, you see. But because of circumstances, because there were problems, because the men cannot handle too much, you see, you know, two wives or three wives, and then on top of that his children, then on top of that to handle the congregation, you see. So circumstances dictated that it's not good. Just like he said, it's not good under the circumstances to get married. He didn't preach celibacy. He was talking about circumstances, and some people take it as a law and the marriage law. And so you've got there, you know, a group of celibate people. And what's the problem in the process? Well, since they're still men, all women will become nuns and men will become monks, or, you know, they call them fathers. Well, they're still human beings and they have desires, and so they commit fornication. You see, that's not God's way. A person burns, let him marry. That's what Paul is saying. And so you have to understand a lot of these laws. And someone who was talking about an elder under the circumstances said, well, an elder shall have only one wife. Not because it is immoral against the law of God, you see, but because the circumstances are not good for that. And in those days, circumstances were fine, you know, for a man to have two wives. And in the future, since God is going to abundantly bless His children all around the earth, you see, the circumstances would not exist where a man would need more than one wife. And so when you study the law of God, take all that into consideration, otherwise you're going to misunderstand many laws of God and you would not like them. And you're going to find yourself without realizing it, resenting God for having, you know, certain kind of laws. And people actually do it. Either the reason around it, they spiritualize them, or they say, well, this is not what He meant. They don't like it, or they just plain hate it. They don't like God, and they don't like this law. And obviously, that's not right either. And so, we'll continue here now with the birthright. As we mentioned last time, what does double portion? Because it's saying here that if he has two women, you know, that's a circumstance, or may have, for that matter, several wives, but the first one, whether he likes her or not, whether she is an old person, you know, wrinkled or ugly, whatever it may be, it's neither here nor there. He cannot favor, you know, the most beautiful woman he has, you know, the youngest or whatever it may be. God says, that's the law. I lay it down. That's the way you do it. You give it to the firstborn, regardless of whether you love, you know, his mother or not. And so he said, you give, and according to the law of the firstborn, he said in verse 17, but he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the hated. You know, she doesn't have to be hated, but this is the circumstance, you see. The law doesn't change. You have to give it to the firstborn. Is it easy? He said, you love your neighbor as yourself, and certainly your wife. So you would think the instruction should be, you know, what business do you have to even hate your wife? But God works with the circumstances. People are going to be that way. They're carnal. And carnal people does not mean people do not have the Holy Spirit. And Paul made it very plain. The law is spiritual, but I am carnal, soul under sin. And sometimes we forget that. All of us are carnal. You see, we have the Holy Spirit, but that doesn't mean that we're totally, totally filled with the Holy Spirit and there is no ounce of carnality in us. We all know that very well. You see? So, he deals with the circumstance. You know, you hate her. You shouldn't, but you do, because you're commanded to love your wife as your own body. But even, you know, under those instructions, people still hate their wives, and wives hate their husbands, and so forth, all kind of reasons. There's carnality in all of us, and sometimes, you know, there is a good reason for it, and other times, it's not. But the circumstance is that a woman is hated, and God says, you should acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the hated, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the firstfruits of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. And the way they divided their inheritance, as I mentioned a while back, speaking about the same subject, let's say if you have $10 million, you see, and you've got 10 children, you don't give $1 million to each, you see, you divide the 10 into 11 portions, and that's how you end up with 2 for 1, which means the rest will get less. But less does not mean they get very little while he gets everything. And that was a false concept about Joseph, because to begin with, people don't understand what Joseph is all about. And they forgot that Joseph not only took care of all of his brothers and sisters, but he took care of all of Egypt. And what do you find in Joseph? You find, in essence, people of all the nations of the earth. And they own, you know, a sizable portion of the property. You see, Joseph doesn't own it all. So let's understand, you know, what the birthright that Joseph received. It didn't mean that he, Joseph, you know, received everything all to himself, and all the others have very little. It doesn't work like that. So since people do not even consider reality, when you come to this nation, look how many nations are here, and sizable portions of the country, and when you put them all together, you see, today, not in the beginning, they are by far larger, you see, than Joseph. That tells you something. You know, whether you talk about the people that came from Africa, or you talk about the people that came from Latin America, you talk about the people that came from Asia, or Europe, Russia, Slavic countries, and beside the Israelites, you see. What is left of Joseph? Not many. You see? A lot of people don't understand that either. That's why some people are also mixed up about who is Ephraim and who is Manasseh. Because they're just taking, you know, a large figure, you know, the number of the people in this land, 280 million, they compared with Britain, they forget the majority in Britain are English people. Well, the majority in this country are not. And so it is in Canada also, and for that matter in other countries where Israel is. But anyway, this is what he says here, and that's what it means, double portion. And then when Joseph is brought back to the land, what do you see? The land is divided again among the tribes of Israel, and just like it was in the days of old, where Joseph received only 2 portions, he didn't receive 90% of the blessings and 10% for the rest of Israel. He received 2 plots of land instead of 1. Why? Because Joseph became 2 tribes. That's why Jacob was adopting them as 2. So each one of them receives a portion, and you don't see them receiving 70% or 80% of the land, and the rest only the remnant of it, and so it would be in the future. And then when he gets to the gates of Jerusalem, each one of them, Joseph is going to have only 1 gate. Both in the Jerusalem of Jesus Christ and the Jerusalem later on of the heavenly Jerusalem. So, you know, the double portion, the birthright, has to be understood properly. And even when the blessing is huge, you also have to study what's really behind it. And then you begin to comprehend and perceive it for what it is, instead of having false notions about what it is and building on that doctrines and attitudes and so forth. And so in verse 18, now we switch to another subject. Again, that's the law of God. Had it been abided by today and had people followed it, things would have been different, but they're not. If a man have a son and a stubborn and rebellious son that will not hearken to the voice of his father or the voice of his mother. And how does he get to this point? Well, to begin with, that his parents spoiled him from a very young age. They did not educate him properly. They did not use the chairman of the board, to work him, now and there when he needs it, you see, or the belt or whatever it may be, without abusing him, without hurting him, as some do, unfortunately, they go from one extreme to the other, just to get his attention, just like you train, a dog and a horse and all that. And, you got to train yourself likewise. You have to discipline yourself in order to achieve anything in life. Without it, you don't achieve nothing, you see. And so it is with a child. So obviously the parents weren't doing their job. That's already telling you that there is iniquity in the family, for whatever is, the reason is. Either division between the husband and wife, each one has their own opinion of how to raise kids. Well, the society around it is already corrupt. And therefore, even if the parents are trying to do their best, the society around corrupt the child, whatever, the reason could be. In other words, this statement tells you about an awful lot. The state of the society, the state of the family. Well, this is the result. This is the circumstances that we find here, and God is telling you how to deal with it under the circumstances. Ideally, it shouldn't be. But since it is, what do you do about it? And so if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, that will not hearken to the voice, will not listen to the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, because it says, that's a command, honor your father and mother. You've got to listen to them. And you don't. You see, if you get to the point where, for whatever reason, even if it is their fault, because they have not properly raised you, there is going to be a penalty one way or the other. Either directly, as it is here, or later on, some other people who are going to behave just like you are going to whack you, and what do you get by that? If you don't behave yourself, nobody else does. It's a chain reaction, vicious cycle. And so he says, okay, you got to take care of the problem before it spreads. So if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son that will not listen to the voice of his father or mother, and though they chasten him, well, now it's maybe too late, because they haven't done it when he should have been chastened. Now he developed, his own personality and rebellious spirit. And so even when they're chasing him, a lot of kids get to the point, no matter what you do, nothing works with them. Their spirit is so corrupt and bent out of shape, nothing works at that point. Because it was not done properly in the beginning. A farmer knows that, if you want to grow a tree in a certain way, or a plant, you got to do it when it's tender, and after that it's too late. So it is with human beings, and even more complex. The situation is. And so he says, and though they had chastened him and will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall lay hold on him. I guess it's small enough for them to handle, and bring him out unto the elders of the city. In essence, they're saying, we failed. We cannot do our job. And so that's to the shame of the family. The whole city now knows, here's so-and-so are not capable of handling their own kid. And so, in other words, now the authority has to take care of it. The city. And the city elders, who are going to be those people? Well, they're basically a great-great-uncle or great-uncle or great-father, great-grandfather or grandfather. And, elders of the city. And the city was made of families. So think about the situation. It's not like today. You go to foreigners, you don't know from Adam. You see, those were still family members, but, they're mature members of the family. That were in that position of the elders, the leaders of their own family, the household. It's beyond the individual family. And so they shall take him to the elders of the city and unto the gate of his place. And that's the place where the elders sat, and that's the place where judgment was being rendered, and that's the place where the priests sat, and that's the place where generally, the dispense of truth, of knowledge of the law, you see. So the gate of the city, had a lot of meaning. It's not just a gate, a door where you just go in and go out. It's a place where people sat and discussed and did all kind of things like that after work. And many things happened at that place, and that's basically where the synagogue was. And the priest, would sit in that place when people needed to have an advice, guidance, counsel, whatever it may be. And so they took you to the took that child. It could be a boy, it could be a girl. In this case, God speaks about a boy, because they generally tend to be more, rowdy than girls, rebel rousers. And so they're taken to the elders of the city, into the gate of the place, and the gate of the place is basically that's where the old folks come, so to speak, and all the people come there. And so the whole city now is aware of that, and that's a lot of shame for the family. So think about all the circumstances behind it. And so they shall send to the elders of the city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He does not listen to our voice. He's a glutton and a drunkard. He's not willing to work. We feed him. He drinks and eats, and that's all he wants to do. You see? He just likes to eat or likes to party, wherever it may be. A lot of people are that way today. That's one of the curses that God talked about. As for my people in Isaiah, he says, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. And that's not ideal. That's not right. That's not the way God made it. But that's an outcome of iniquity on the part of all. And so this is what we read here. This boy is in that state of mind. You know, he's a glutton and a drunkard. And what happens now? You know, they check into the matter. By now, you would think that being a family, you know, society, and everybody's all around you there, they basically know what's happening within their community, you know, within their family. You're talking about uncles and cousins and nephews and nieces and relatives. That's basically the situation is, not like we have today. And so, it's not something new. They all know it. And in essence, they say, well, it's about time you do something about it. Well, what is it that God said you do about it? And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones, that he die. You see? And imagine that. For the parents, they have to come to that point where that's the end of the road. There is nothing you can do about the kid. And if he continues like that, what happens to a kid like that if he continues? He gets into violence. He gets into crime. You know, he gets next door neighbors, you know, girls pregnant and, you know, so forth. You know, all kind of things like that. And creates an awful lot of problems. You know, they join gangs. They all get together and they do all kind of evil things in the city. Well, God says, don't get to that point. As long as it is just one person, that's the time to nip it in the bud. You know, the whole problem that is going to be created if kids like that are going to continue to be that way and then join one another and do even much more evil. So, think about it from that point of view. Much has gone into this situation before it got to that point. This is the bottom line. This is the end of the road. And God says, that's the way to solve it. Let everybody stone him. So shall you put away the evil from the midst of you, and all Israel, all the boys in Israel, you see, young and old, especially young people, all Israel shall hear and fear. Now the adults, the parents are going to learn, look, if we don't treat our children properly, if we do not discipline them, if we do not educate them with love, with kindness and mercy and firmness, we might have to end up like that. Our whole family is going to be shamed. The whole city is going to know about it. Who would want to give their son or daughter to a family like that? Who would want to do business with people like that? You see what I mean? An awful lot of things revolve around it. So everybody's going to hear and fear. Not say, oh, well, who cares? It doesn't work like that, even though there are a lot of fools out there that claim, well, death penalty does not deter anybody, anything. Or the person who is being put to death, he doesn't commit crime anymore, does he? You see? And those in his own family are going to be scared and afraid. They're not going to follow in the footsteps of their bad brother or bad sister or whatever it may be. And the family around it, especially in small community when everybody knew everybody, now something like that happens, you can imagine the impact that it's going to have on the community. That's what God is saying here. God knows the human mind. God knows what works. Not people, not, you know, so-called humanists or psychologists or whatever it may be. And oftentimes men of religion, in their ignorance and blindness, they get always into the action against the law of God of dealing with the evil and getting rid of it, and they want the evil to continue. Why? You know, because the perverted concept of the love of God. Oh, God loves you. Jesus loves you. You know, can't do that. Can't take a human life. Why not? That human life didn't mind, you know, taking the lives of others, destroying others, you know, leaving a trail of iniquity behind him and destruction and hurt feelings and violence and things like that. You see, there is insanity in the land. And that's the reason why God finally, you know, he's saying, you know, unless you return to the law of Moses and do exactly what I told you to do, I'm going to destroy all of you. Not only your son, who is rebellious, but all of you. The parents who haven't done the job either, and the society, and the community. And unfortunately, 90% of humanity is going to be blotted out from under heaven at the coming of Christ, and only 9%, that is 10%, will be left. And even they, you know, are going to need the rod of iron of Jesus Christ is going to reign over them, the rebellious among them. It's going to take a while before they calm down and begin to behave themselves and say, yes, sir. And only the very few would really be obedient at that time. But gradually, you know, the whole earth, the 10% that will be again become also multitudes of peoples, you know, gradually they're going to be trained, disciplined, taught properly. The knowledge of the Lord shall fill the face of the whole earth. It's a gradual process that in essence takes a whole 1,000 years. Imagine that. Why does Christ need to reign 1,000 years? As you read in the writings of the Apostle Paul, he says that Christ is going to reign, speaking about the resurrection chapter, 1 Corinthians 15. Christ is going to reign for 1,000 years until all of his enemies are put down under him. Because people are not going to fall in line just immediately, just because, you know, even though they went through the tribulation after that, you know, new generations are born and maybe they don't remember, you know, all kind of things like that and develop problems. So even then, the reality continues. And God has to deal with it. And that's why the rod of iron. But the stuff of the shepherd for those who are obedient. So you're still going to have variations there in behavior. And so God says, that's why you do it. I want everybody to hear and fear. And that's going to be for the best of the society. That's love. Hatred is do nothing about it. Let it get away with. And then everybody is infested with the problem. And everybody's paying the penalty. And that's in essence what society is all about. You see? We allow all kind of things like that. And we're all paying the penalty for it. Even, you know, doing innocent things like going to the supermarket. Why are the prices so high in many places? Because there are a lot of thievery. Or in the shopping stores, the malls, things like that. So the merchants, you know, have to raise their prices, you see. And all along the way, here and there, to make up for the stolen goods and merchandise and things like that. And all of us are paying for it. So let's understand that. The world in which we are and why it is the way it is. We made it that way. Every single one of us is guilty of it to one degree or the other. That's why God says to all of us, unless you repent, not your neighbor, you, God is going to bring utter destruction on all of us. And so, this is what happens here, you know. Enough is enough. That's what the parents are saying. The community, in essence, says also, enough is enough. And that's what God is saying. Enough is enough. And then he steps in, and that's bad news for an awful lot of us, the majority of us, at that point. And so, here we read another law. And if a man, verse 22, have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but you shall surely bury him the same day, for he that is hanged is a reproach unto God. Now you have to understand what is really happening here. This is not the hanging that we know. You know, the hanging man? This is not the crucifixion. You hang somebody on the cross. You see, this is not the invention of God. That's the invention of the devil. Demonic minds invented that. And unfortunately, in this country, they used to do it too. You hang a person alive. No, the hanging that was done in Israel was after the death occurred. Then they hang the person, you know, just to let everybody see. It's not that everybody is going to come and see somebody being hanged, you know, they like to see it. You know, there's something, you know, fiendish in our character that we like to see those kind of horrible things. And any time they had hangings in this country, you know, a lot of people came all over the world, that is all over the place, you know, they just wanted to see it. Now, that's not the nature of God, you see, in terms of the hanging. Because this is what, basically later on, when people did not do it properly, that's when the Romans... As a matter of fact, Romans were not the first one, you know. The commentary says it was a Roman invention, and that's not true, because the Assyrian people, you know, the people that became later on the German people, they were using it in their days, you see, and that's long, long, long before Rome came on the scene. And crucifixion was there from the beginning of time, in the heart of people who wanted to torment, to torture, and keep somebody alive for days. You know, that's what crucifixion was all about. Keep them alive for days and suffer and suffer and suffer until they're totally gone. And but you know, in Israel, basically, you know, the death penalty was executed either by stoning, burning, you see, the sword, and strangulation, and hanging was sometimes added after death, you know, as a token of infamy. And that was the purpose of it, you know, as a further deterrent. And so when they hang them on that tree, you see, because when you burn somebody, well, it takes you, it doesn't take long, you know, as painful as it is. And when you stone somebody, you know, it takes a few moments, you know, hit him in the head or something like that, and it just drops dead. When you strangle them, obviously they're gone, you see. And with the sword, you know, it's immediate. But with the hanging, after you kill them, then for a whole day they lie there, or, you know, they hang there, and everybody sees them. You see? And that's different. Because after you kill someone, burn someone, stone someone, they immediately are buried. But here it is for a whole day, he's hanging there. And imagine the whole family has to walk by, all the neighbors, the relatives and all that, and they know who that guy is. And that's a horrible shame. And that's what it says, and it's a reproach unto God. And so it was said about Jesus Christ, cursed be he that hangs on a tree. In other words, it's a reproach. It's a curse. It's not a blessing. Because it brings an awful lot of shame and humiliation on the family, and for generations to come, people are going to remember that, you know, so-and-so from this family was hanging on a tree, and everybody was looking at it, and you know how people feel about it, and their emotions are developed. So that was the worst thing that can happen to you, not only to be killed, destroyed, whatever, but, you know, to be left there hanging all day. But still, God says, no more than one day. You see? No more than one day. It should be there. You should bury him the same day. And that's why this law is to this very day in the Jewish community, that when somebody dies, he must be buried the same day he died. And you don't keep them in the coroner's office, you know, for a couple of weeks there so you can examine him. Sometimes they're there for a few weeks before you get to them. That's against the law of God. And that's why the religious authorities in Israel does not allow that. And so when you go to Israel, that's where you're buried, the same day you die. You see? Other people, unfortunately, you know, as time goes by, they depart from that even in Israel, and some people are put in a freezer, and yet that's against the law of God. So families basically require an immediate burial. And so when you hear about somebody die, if you happen to be abroad, if you don't make it the same day, you would miss the funeral, because they bury them the same day they, you know, they died. And basically it's from this law that they do it. And so God says, you hang him, yes, and then that's after you killed him, whichever way. And then you hang him because the person that is hanged is a reproach unto God, that you defile not your land, which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance. So God is saying that leaving a person there beyond one day defiles the land, and it defiles the attitudes of people, and develops contempt in them, you see. And, you know, it creates a lot of problems when you have that. And that's why God never would allow, you know, crucifixion as a form of punishment because of that. And yet this is the very thing that he himself was willing to take upon himself. Something that is far beyond an ordinary death, you see. Death penalty either by stoning, like Stephen, or the sword, or strangulation, or fire. He was hanged alive, and that's contrary to the law of God. And people sometimes survived, up to a week or something like that, in that position. And everybody goes by and they wag their head, you know, and they spit at them, you know, that they curse them, and that's what it was with the criminals that were hanged on a tree like that. In other words, hanged on a cross. And there were different ways of doing it. And so God forbade that, because he says that defiles the land, that defiles the nature, you know, and the character of the people. You see, God didn't want that. God is a God of mercy, God is a God of justice, God is a God of vengeance, but God is not a God of cruelty. You see, he does not want people to develop malicious attitudes and thoughts and become demonized in their own nature. And that's unfortunately what Rome was doing in Assyria and many in other nations that followed that. And then we continue with chapter 22, verse 1. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep driven away and hide yourself from them, you shall surely bring them back unto your brother. So, the law, from the beginning of time, you are your brother's keeper, is still here. You see? That was a part of the law that was given in the Garden of Eden. And Cain, being a rebellious person against God and the law of God, what was his statement? Am I my brother's keeper? Of course you are. You see? God demands that we are our brother's keeper. And yet people say, well, I don't care. And then the whole city functions like that. You know, a crime is committed in the city. Nobody opens the window or the door. They don't want to get involved. And they don't realize that what they don't do for others, others wouldn't do for them. They're going to end up paying the penalty. And God does not deliver many people because of that. He allows rape. He allows murder. He allows horrible crime to happen. Because all of us, to one degree or the other, have learned to be not our brother's keeper, but our brother's haters. We don't care. No concern. We don't want to get involved. Let somebody else do it. And therefore, all of us are paying the penalty, and it never dawns on us what our actions are going to do and to create, and the vicious cycle is going to create that is going to come back and haunt us. You know, it's a boomerang effect that it has. You know, what goes around comes around. God says he better be your brother's keeper. So he found a donkey, whether you like him, whether you know who that person is, neither he nor there. You know, just take it, take care of it until your brother, comes searching for it to give it to him. Why? Another time, your donkey might get lost, your property, whatever it may be, and your neighbor is going to do the same thing for you. That's harmony and unity. That's love. See? So when somebody commits crime, if it's not taken care of, it's going to create a chain reaction. But if you nip it in the bud, you see, it's going to put an end to it. On the other hand, if you do something good, it's going to go around. And it'll come back to you when you are in need. And that's the way the law of God works. We keep it, it keeps us. We break it, it breaks us. That's the nature of it. And that's what he's saying here. You shall surely bring him back unto your brother. Well, if you know your brother, you bring it to him. But, and if your brother be not nigh unto you, and you know him not, you don't know who that person is, and then shall you bring it home to your house, and it shall be with you until your brother require it, and he shall restore it to him. Because sooner or later, somebody's going to look for his donkey. You see? Or his whatever. And so you just keep it, take care of it. That's your responsibility. And you don't say, well, you know, I don't want to spend my money, you know, feeding this donkey or things like that. If you begin to think like that, you don't realize you're going to sign your own, you know, future. In other words, not death warranty, but, you know, your own problems. Because somebody else is going to find your donkey. They wouldn't want to feed it. You know, by the time you find it, it looks so emaciated, you know. Why? Because the guy said, look, I didn't want to spend money on your donkey, and I have no money to spend on your donkey. Well, obviously, you don't want that to happen. So God says, think about it. Understand the law. Understand the purpose and the reason for it. And when you meditate on it day and night and understand why, and then you do it also, then you have a good understanding. And then you learn to love the law of God because you realize how good it is, and then you realize that's the very nature of God, and then you love God with all of your being and with all of your heart, because everything He tells us, even though at the moment doesn't look good, after all, a poverty-stricken family might have found, you know, this donkey. What are they going to do about it? To begin with, they have a hard time feeding themselves. You see? And they say, well, we don't care, you know, we're not going to do anything about it, you know, we cannot feed it, things like that. And what's going to happen? You see? Well, other people are going to treat them that way, and they know one day, you know, this poor family loses their donkey, and somebody else treats their donkey the way they treated somebody else's donkey. You see, it's not a good idea. And so, God is wanting His people to think about all these ramifications and act accordingly. And so, as people would say, whatever you want, you know, people to do to you, do it unto them. Or whatever people, you know, whatever you want people do to you, you do unto them. You know, it goes back and forth. Christ put it one way, the rabbis were teaching it the other way. You see? And it goes both ways. And that's what the law, the royal law, is all about. Love your neighbor as yourself. It's not love toward yourself to ignore your your brother's property. Because you're going to have to pay the penalty down the road and many, many times over, maybe. Well, anyway, we'll stop at this point. Again, this is Mordecai Joseph, greetings to all of God's people. Until next lesson.